Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ali Abu Nima, author and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada News website, who describes the humanitarian crisis unfolding in Gaza and the chronology of events which led to the current conflict. Namika Zion, a member of the group Other Voice in Sderot, Israel, who explains why she and other Israelis have come together to engage in a dialogue with Palestinians from Gaza and is calling for an immediate ceasefire. And Ohio attorney Cliff Arnebeck, who discusses the untimely death of GOP internet strategist Mike Connell and the investigation surrounding his activities during the counting of Ohio ballots in the 2004 presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Barack Obama has started making the rounds on Capitol Hill to sell his $750 billion economic stimulus package. In Great Britain, Prime Minister Gordon Brown is also trying to ease the pain of recession with a promise to create 100,000 jobs through spending on public works, school repairs, hospital projects, and new investment in broadband communications technology. According to the Christian Science Monitor, there's concern among financial analysts that the rest of the developed world, most of Europe and Japan, will not do enough to stimulate economic growth. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, in particular, has come under criticism for not acknowledging the seriousness of the economic crisis. China has also proposed a massive fiscal stimulus package to deal with the crisis caused by shrinking exports. There is also fear the global recession will increase trade tensions as economies like India, Russia, and Brazil erect trade barriers. Global economist Tu Packard insists this is not the time to be worried about budget deficits, nor will stimulus by government crowd out other investments by competing with the private sector and credit markets. Packard of Moody'sEconomy.com adds, "The consequences, if we do not respond in a vigorous way, could be even more devastating." Ghana's left-of-center opposition leader John Atta Mills won a razor-tight runoff race to become the next president of the West African nation. This was the second time power was legitimately transferred from one leader to another in Ghana after almost 20 years of coups and dictatorship. Only days after the results were announced, there were fears that Ghana might explode like Kenya did last year if Ghana's Electoral Commission did not recognize the opposition's victory. The final tally was delayed for several days because elections in several districts had to be rerun. Mills won by 70,000 votes out of 9 million votes cast. Former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan returned to his native Ghana on New Year's Day to work behind the scenes to calm tensions. On January 3rd, Mills was declared the victor. Mills, a law professor and former vice president, had lost two earlier races against retiring President John Kufuor. According to the BBC, Mills sees himself as a social democrat willing to defend the social welfare ideas of Kwame Nkrumah. Despite its recent prosperity, Ghana suffers from major social challenges, including a high rate of youth unemployment, falling remittances from Ghanaians working abroad, and a 40% illiteracy rate. In the waning days of last fall's presidential campaign, the Pentagon brass had already sent a strong message to the next president. Defense officials want an additional $450 billion spending hike over the next 5 years. The Pentagon has a $515 billion budget for fiscal year 2009. Military spending is set to increase to $527 billion in 2010. In addition, supplemental spending for the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the War on Terror has totaled $860 billion since 2001. The incoming Obama administration, already committed to a nearly trillion-dollar stimulus package, universal health care, and a bailout of the auto industry, will be hard-pressed to find funding for these priorities. The new administration will likely face a nasty battle if it tries to cancel the F-22 combat fighter designed in the 1980s to fight Soviet-era aircraft. The F-22 has strong support in Congress and among defense lobbyists. Each fighter costs $300 million to produce. Progressive security analysts, affiliated with the think tank Foreign Policy in Focus, have identified $61 billion of cost savings from the Pentagon budget. The analysts suggest using the money to fund programs to prevent nuclear proliferation and strengthening the diplomatic corps. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino. Thank you.
As the world looked on in horror, the Israeli air and ground assault on Gaza entered its 11th day, with three Israeli artillery shells hitting a United Nations school in northern Gaza, killing at least 30 and wounding 55 Palestinians. Those killed and injured included men, women, and children who had taken refuge in and around the UN building. The Israeli military maintains that its forces had responded to mortar fire coming from the school. Israel's government, which has barred Western reporters from entering Gaza to report on the siege, states that six of its soldiers have died in Gaza since the start of the ground attack. Palestinian medical officials estimate that the death toll in Gaza had reached 560 on January 6th, since Israel launched airstrikes against the territory on December 27th. The UN says one-third of those killed are civilians. A humanitarian crisis at Gaza hospitals has been reported, where thousands of injured Palestinians sought urgent treatment from under-equipped facilities, a result of an 18-month Israeli blockade of basic provisions such as food, fuel, and medicine. Despite the relentless Israeli attack, leaders of Gaza's Islamic Hamas government have vowed to fight on, and the group continues to launch dozens of crude rockets into southern Israel. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas plans to present a resolution drafted by the Arab League to the UN Security Council, which calls on Israel to halt their offensive and for Hamas to stop firing rockets at the Jewish state. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ali Abu Nima, author and co-founder of the electronic Intifada News website, who describes the humanitarian crisis unfolding in Gaza and the chronology of events which led to the current conflict.
Well, the death toll is now over 540 people, and in fact, the vast majority of them are civilians, much higher than 200. At least one-third of them are women and children. Hospital sources in the Gaza Strip have said that 50% of the injured coming into the hospital are children, which makes sense, and because 50% of the population of the Gaza Strip are children, it's a very young population, so that shows the indiscriminate nature of the bombing that's going on, that the number of children injured is almost exactly proportional to the number of children in the population. What Israel calls terrorists includes virtually every Palestinian male. In fact, dozens of those who were killed in the initial days of Israel's attacks were ordinary traffic policemen. Israel massacred, I think there's no other word, it bombed a graduation ceremony for traffic police officers. These were people who'd just undergone training for how to manage traffic, and Israel bombed them out of the sky. Of course, Israel has been, as we've been hearing in the media and seeing, Israel has bombed 10 mosques. It bombed the Islamic University, which has 18,000 students, 60% of them women. It bombed the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Education, the Palestinian Legislative Council building, which ironically houses the only democratically elected parliament in the Arab world, in addition to bombing the sewage system, water. It's just indiscriminate. This 10 days of hell comes on top of months and months of a deliberate starvation siege in which Israel put the Gaza Strip on a drip feed, blocking most food and medicine from coming in, blocking people from going in and out, just really imprisoning. As a Norwegian doctor who's in Gaza said on CBS News, he said that Israel is bombing 1.5 million people in a cage. Israel's propaganda that, you know, we're doing this because Hamas fired rockets at us is about as true as the claim that we had to invade Iraq because there are weapons of mass destruction. And the mantra about rockets serves exactly the same function as the mantra about weapons of mass destruction. The reality is there had been a truce. Hamas had observed it meticulously from June 19th. Until Israel attacked the Gaza Strip on November 4th, killing six Palestinians, and that's when the truce broke down. And they were willing to renew the truce, but what they weren't willing to do is to say, look, I mean, the Israeli idea of a truce is, you know, you stay silent, you starve to death, you stay caged in the Gaza Strip, and if you stay quiet while we starve you to death, then we won't bomb you. That was the Israeli idea of a truce, and Palestinians said, you know, we're dying anyway, they're killing us anyway, so we might as well resist.
There's a lot of criticism here in the United States and Israel, of course, of Hamas's decision to launch rockets into southern Israel. But you're saying, from what I understand, that Hamas's decision to launch rockets was predicated on that may have been the only bargaining chip they had in order to negotiate a new ceasefire that would have allowed medical supplies and basic food to get in there. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. There was not one single rocket fired by Hamas from June 19th until Israel attacked the Gaza Strip on November 4th. Between June 19th and November 4th, there were a total of 26 rockets fired at the Gaza Strip, not by Hamas, by other factions which Hamas restrained. I mean, this is a very tiny number, and they caused no injuries or deaths. The only Israeli deaths, which have totaled now three from rocket attacks, happened since December 27th when Israel launched its attack. And I can tell you with certainty that more Israelis have died in traffic accidents since it started the attack on December 27th than from rockets.
What do you expect from Barack Obama when he takes the oath of office on January 20th? Is he going to bring any new ideas, new perspectives into solving this many decades long problem of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians?
I wish I could say I believed that he would, but from everything I've seen, and I've studied it very carefully, I think that he is more likely to continue with the Bush administration's one-sided support for Israel than to break with that. And that's very sad, and that's very dangerous, not just for Palestinians and Israelis, but also for the United States. So I think this is the moment when he needs to hear from Americans who say, this is an area where we want real change. If we're just going to go on supporting Israeli occupation, supporting the blockade on Gaza, opposing democracy for Palestinians, then it's just going to compound the crisis and the violence. We need real change, but he needs to hear it.
That was Ali Abu Nima, co-founder of the electronicintifada.net news website and author of the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. While more Hamas rockets fall on Israeli towns and cities, and Israeli troops continue their ground operations in Gaza, the Israeli town of Sderot on the Gaza border is a flashpoint. Israel says it attacked Gaza to stop the rockets from falling on Sderot and nearby towns, and most Israelis reportedly support the military action of the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF. But a group of Israeli citizens of Sderot and other parts of southern Israel near Gaza have formed a group called Other Voice. The group makes common cause with the suffering Palestinians in Gaza and calls for a renewed ceasefire on both sides, a ceasefire they say Israel broke first. Other Voice members have been in touch with Gazans by cell phone and email. They planned a joint bike ride along both sides of the border last August to demonstrate their mutual support for peace, but that plan was derailed by internal conflicts in Gaza. Communication has become much more difficult since Israel's recent military assault, which Sderot residents said included bombing cell phone towers in Gaza. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nomika Zion, a founding member of Other Voice. She is director of the Center for Social Justice at the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem, but works mostly from home in a safe room to provide protection from the dozens of incoming Hamas rockets launched across the border daily. Though they have caused very few injuries, these rockets take a heavy emotional toll on residents. Zion explains that the cross-border dialogue is vital to ensure that the human dimension of the conflict on both sides is kept in perspective.
We found that we share together the same attitude, the same feelings, that we want to create a dialogue with people from Gaza, that we want to open a human channel. It was very, very moving for me and very, very important because many times I felt that I'm almost alone here in this voice. I mean, to see our neighbors from Gaza as partners. We are living in the same area, and not as an enemy, to see the human face of the other side and not just see them as people with no face, no voice, no pain. We are not speaking in one voice. We all the time we ask ourselves questions, and we need to define our voice or our identity again and again in this group. But what everybody agree in the group is to create connection with the people from Gaza. Talk to them. Listen to them. Okay? The human voice. Let's say the human voice. So unfortunately, we couldn't meet each other. So we did it via cell phone. And it was very painful dialogue because of the closures, because they cannot get out, because they lack in a very tiny place, the biggest prison in the world, and so on. They don't have enough supply, and so on. So this is what we spoke about with them. And we try to organize the mutual activities together. We realize that it's very, very difficult to find other voice group of Palestinians from the other side. We spoke to them many times about it. Why can you organize a group of Palestinians which raise another voice in your place? And of course, there is no democracy there. They cannot gather like that, like us, every week. They cannot express their opinion freely. It's not, of course, it's very, very difficult. They risk their lives sometimes because they were very afraid from the Hamas. But over this year, over the time, we built relationship only by voices, yes, with the other side. And we heard about their life. They heard about us. This is what happened mainly.
Nomika Zion, what has your life been like since the escalation of hostilities that began on December 27th?
For me, it's very, very difficult. I'm so, I'm hardly can work or focus on nothing but this war. And in our group at the moment, there are many different voices. Some of the people support the war. Some of the people don't, like me. We are communicate all the time via mail. We express our feelings, our views, our attitude to what happened. Everybody, our hearts are broken because of what happened in Gaza, yes? Even those people in other voice group which support this military action feel broken from the picture from Gaza. I can't identify with this brutal military operation. I can't identify. I don't feel protected at the moment. We should remember that the IDF broke the ceasefire. He entered there because of one of the tunnels, and then he invaded again, and they killed around 20 Palestinians. And then we realized we are going to face another round of escalation. And we were very, very afraid. So other voice group, we wrote a petition to Ehud Olmert and to Ehud Barak. So, and we asked them, we begged, we said, we tried to explain that it was very, very important, crucial for us, critical to us to this ceasefire. It was so important. It was the only option for people to get back to normal life, to get more strength, to run normal life again. And we beg and we said, don't try to find any channel for a dialogue, to achieve agreement, secret agreement, long-term agreement, and to get another ceasefire for a longer time, okay, for a long term. We may not cope with another escalation and with another round of violence, okay? And we wanted to explain all of this and to ask him to do whatever they can do as a government to find a way for a dialogue, for agreement, and not to choose always the violent option.
Did you get a response from the Israeli government?
They didn't show up. I'm not sure that we have enough strength to face another escalation. And now this is what happened. When the IDF broke the ceasefire, we knew exactly what is going to be.
That was Nomika Zion, a founding member of the group Other Voice in Sderot, Israel. Visit the website launched by an Israeli and a Palestinian from Gaza, both participants in the cross-border dialogue, at gazasiderot.blogspot.com. Mike Connell, a top Republican Party internet strategist who was under investigation on allegations that he was involved in possible tampering with the counting of Ohio ballots in the 2004 presidential election, died in a plane crash on December 19th. Connell, who was piloting his own small plane when it crashed near the Akron-Canton Airport, was the chief information technology consultant to former presidential advisor Karl Rove and had created the official state website for posting Ohio's presidential election returns in 2004. The election results in Ohio that year determined the winner of the presidential contest between Republican George Bush and Democrat John Kerry. As part of a lawsuit initiated by election integrity activists, Connell had given a deposition to Ohio attorneys Cliff Arnebeck and Bob Fitrakis. In the deposition, Connell was asked to describe his work on behalf of the GOP related to the counting of votes in Ohio after the 2004 election and his knowledge of former presidential advisor Karl Rove's missing email file sought by Congress. Connell's death occurred after several sources reported that the Republican strategist's life could be under threat from Karl Rove and others concerned about his testimony in the 2004 election investigation. Attorney Arnebeck, having heard about the threats, alerted both U.S. Attorney General Michael Mukasey and Ohio Attorney General Nancy Rogers to provide protection to Mr. Connell, but the request for security was not offered. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Attorney Arnebeck, who discusses the circumstances surrounding Mike Connell's untimely death and how his investigation will now proceed.
Well, we had a news conference July 17th of this year in which we indicated that we were intending to file a racketeering claim against Karl Rove as the principal perpetrator of a racketeering conspiracy, and we identified Mike Connell as a key witness in that case. And within a few days of that news conference, we got a tip from someone identifying himself as within the McCain campaign, and he reported that Rove had threatened Mike Connell that if he didn't take the fall and not implicate Rove in any of the problems in 2004 Ohio, that his wife would be prosecuted. So we're working with a Republican consultant or expert who made some inquiries within his circles and who came back and said he believed that the threat was credible. On that basis, we advised the Attorney General of the United States, the Ohio Attorney General, and the federal court chambers that a witness that we had identified, we had reason to believe was being threatened. And so we put the alarm bell out there. The tips continued, and the last one indicated that Connell was in danger from Rove. And it was at that point we were successful in getting federal court to order Mr. Connell to appear in federal court and then also to submit to a deposition. And all that took place about a month before this crash.
So what happens now to your investigation? And maybe you could specify exactly the kind of evidence that you've accumulated so far to press your claim that Karl Rove and, by extension, Mike Connell, who's now deceased, were involved in tampering with the vote totals in Ohio during the 2004 presidential election.
Well, we rely upon our expert in terms of Mr. Connell's role. And he's indicating that, to the best of his knowledge, Connell was a technical guy and an IT guy. He may have been present or he may have been witness to some criminal activities, but that he was not a perpetrator of criminal activities himself. So that his role in our case was as a witness because of his involvement in so many, practically every aspect of Karl Rove's activities, many of which were criminal, that was his importance as a witness. We believe, based on the evidence that we've got, that Karl Rove is the perpetrator, is the guy who has gone overboard in pursuing election success and trading off, as a way of getting that success, trading off fundamental values in our country in terms of pledging that if they were elected, they would undermine the rule of law and let business have their way. And pretty much run wild and crazy which of course they did.
This is potentially one of the largest scandals in American political history, if you can get the facts lined up and get this to court. What are your next steps here?
Well, we're, trying to get the involvement of law enforcement, full law enforcement involvement. We believe that the criminal activity that we've identified, we have plenty of evidence to support it. You know, it starts not with the Republican Party. It starts with Karl Rove. The first target of this conspiracy is John McCain's campaign in South Carolina in the 2000 primary. So it's really a criminal enterprise rather than a Republican enterprise. It becomes a Republican enterprise when Rove gets control of the presidency in 2000, and then is inside the White House, functioning in a policy role, in multiple policy roles, engaging in corrupt practices, and basically turning foreign policy and domestic policy into an adjunct of his corrupt sense of partisan political activity, which is really not anything that's part of any American tradition that any of us are familiar with. It's basically using criminal methods to try to establish single-party control, and also do this in cooperation with corrupt business enterprises to give them the opportunity to make monopoly profits, to exploit the American public without regulation, without accountability in tort law or regulatory agencies.
That was Ohio attorney Cliff Arnebeck. For more information about the 2004 election case involving Mike Connell and Karl Rove, visit the websites rovecybergate.com and freepress.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.